Okay, the car's gassed up, and it's time now to head over to Sonoma as we venture out on the wine road. Today's guest, Joel Peterson, was on my radio show once before, but briefly as I conducted interviews at the Zapp Zinfandel Experience a couple of years ago in San Francisco. Joel was a past president of Zapp, the Zinfandel Advocates and Producers. He's currently on the board of directors. His son, Morgan Twain Peterson, an exceptional winemaker on his own, has also been a guest on this podcast. Together, they're part of the Historic Vineyard Society. We'll touch upon that later on. Joel is also the senior vice president of Constellation Brands, the company that now owns Ravenswood. He and I spoke for well over an hour, much of which is contained here. Like many winemakers from Italian and French families, although he isn't, he had the opportunity to be introduced to wine at a very young age.
Yes, indeed. I was introduced very early to wine, and surprising because I have to say that, if anything, my family was Anglo-Saxon Protestant of Viking stock, if you will. And my mother and my father were both interesting people. They were both chemists. My mother was a nuclear chemist who had worked on the atomic bomb. And when I was born, she decided to stay home with me, which was totally out of character for her. And and she got predictably bored, and she didn't know exactly what to do with herself. And to keep herself out of trouble, she decided that cooking would be like chemistry. And so she began to cook, and she ultimately became a really excellent cook. She did a lot of the recipe testing for Alice Waters' first cookbook, The Chapinese Cookbook. But in the process, she read a book by Elizabeth David that said that the French drank wine with their meals. And she said, well, that's a novel idea. She'd grown up in Bolinas, California. Her family was mostly dairy farmers. She'd never had a bottle of wine in her life. Yeah. It wasn't that she didn't drink. You know, they were part of the sailing glut crowd in the Bay Area, and they drank a lot of, gin. So she went looking for a bottle of French wine because that's what she'd read about. And in 1951, it was not so easy to find French wine. She finally ended up in San Francisco at a place called the City of Paris, which is where Neiman Marcus is now, on Union Square. Right. And in the City of Paris, they had a French wine cellar. And so she asked for a bottle of wine that would go with turkey because she was thought, well, wine should be celebratory. So she was going to serve it at Thanksgiving. And the guy gave her a bottle of 1945 Chateau Neuf du Pape. If he'd given her 43, 44, or 46, I wouldn't be here today. But that 45, of course, was a great vintage. That sort of introduced my parents to wine. And they said, eh, this wine stuff is pretty good. You know, and my father got pretty obsessed by it. But my mother said that in 1952, a catalog arrived in the mail in January of 1952. And she said, so we bought it was from Lords & Elwood in Los Angeles. So they bought their first case of wine through the mail, basically.
Wow. Kind of like the Sears and Roebuck catalog back then.
Exactly. That's exactly what it was. And she actually still had the catalog. And she said, by the way, I think the receipt for the first case of wine we ever ordered, this is when she was 83, the first wine we ever ordered is still like in the catalog. And so, like, sure enough, it was there. And it was like this amazing case of wine. It basically was a survey of France to cover all the major growing regions in France. And it included a bottle of 1945 Aubryon and a bottle of 1929 Chateau Yquem. Mm. That entire case of wine cost them $14.50. Yeah, let's just say that it's a little more expensive now.
Yeah, just a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, and
a little more than $1.50 a piece.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the most expensive wine in the case was the Yquem at $3.40, as I recall. And the shipping from Los Angeles to San Francisco was $3.44. I don't think the ratios are the same anymore. So basically, my father got crazy about it, and he started a wine club, and he started writing about wine, and he was not particularly good about writing about wine. He didn't have words that he thought were good, so he began doing kind of the, how do I find words that will allow me to express what the wine tastes like. I mean, because you can't say Chardonnay tastes like Chardonnay. Chardonnay tastes like lots of things. And so he began looking for simple words, and he decided that I'd be a great experiment. At age 10, he said, yeah, I bet you have really simple words for wine. You know, he said, so for the first couple of years, he would invite me down on Friday nights when he was doing his, sort of big tastings, and he would allow me to smell through the wines. And so we smelled, you know, Chardonnay, for instance, since I started there. Yeah, and if I said, well, what's he say, what's it smell like? And I'd say, well, it smells like apples. And he'd say, what kind of apples? And I'd say, I have no idea. And so he would go out and find apples, and he'd cut up apples until we could tell the difference between, you know, Northern Spy and Rum Beauty and Golden Delicious. And wow, whichever ones he did, he cut them up and put in glasses. So literally, next time I smelled a wine that, you know, smelled, you know, like Golden Delicious, I could say, hey, smells like Golden Delicious. That's so he really educated himself, and in the process educated me. And
right.
So essentially by the time I was 18, I had tasted all the great wines of the world. So it wasn't just that we drank wine, they collected wine, and they were part of the Berkeley Wine and Food Society, which was one of the really early groups. So very, very core to the beginning of California's wine scene, but also really key to the understanding of what happened and what was happening in Europe wine-wise. I used to refer to my parents as enotourists, because they discovered that if you went to a place that grew wine, the food was good, the climate was, you know, temperate, and it was frequently beautiful. So they spent a lot of time going to places where grapes were grown. It's like it's not a bad way to plan your vacation.
What a great opportunity for you too at an early age, and to be able to discern the characteristics of wine by the time you're even of drinking age.
Yeah, exactly. It was like by the time I was 18, I was a little bit of a show off. I didn't have enough sense to be humble. but I learned that after a while, you know.
I'm talking with Joel Peterson of Ravenswood Winery. We sat outside their tasting room in Sonoma at a picnic bench for the interview, hence the sound of wind on occasion. At 18 years of age, there wasn't much for a youngster to do in the wine industry, so Joel decided to follow in his parents' footsteps and pursued a degree in science, in microbiology. I asked if that made more sense to him at the time.
Yeah, I actually didn't see the wine business is a business. I mean, I saw it as an avocation. It was something that people enjoyed, and most of the people that I knew that were associated with wine drinking did something else. So there were people like George Linton, who was a veterinarian. There were a lot of doctors and lawyers and Indian chiefs who supported their habit by their profession. So wine wasn't a thing you did for a living. Wine was something you did for pleasure and hobby, and was interesting, and, you know, sort of the secondary intellectual pursuit. So my inclination was to really find something else to do besides, you know, wine, because I didn't even see it as an opportunity. And I was actually interested in oceanography. I'd grown up sailing on the San Francisco Bay and was very interested in going that direction. So I ended up at Oregon State. Oregon State had probably at the time the third best oceanography program in the country. But you still have to be an undergraduate before you can go into the serious part of the oceanography. You can do some work, but not much.
Yeah.
So I ended up with degrees in, you know, science and went off to do medical research, and ended up in, ultimately after take actually took I took a year and traveled around Europe for almost an entire year, just like 1955 Volkswagen that I bought for $55, and just drove. And
wow, what a trip! Yeah. That sounds like fun. But it didn't take long before you started making wine yourself while you were still doing lab research in San Francisco.
Yeah, I had, I had my own little wine group. We called it the Basque Wine Group. It was one of those, where everybody would spontaneously meet at the Basque Hotel, where the food was cheap and plentiful. The only criterion was you bring a bottle of wine, and had to be in a brown bag. And, it was guess what the wine is kind of game idea. But it basically took the prejudice out of, you know, labels and things like that. So you really learned a lot more, and you learned really how to sort of identify wine's wine and do that kind of stuff. I also was part of the Vintners Club. My father had helped establish this thing called the Vintners Club with a guy named Jerry Draper. And it was a going process, or was going getting to go. And my father died suddenly, really just before it was going to open. And I couldn't afford the $5,000 initiation fee, but Jerry was kind enough to sort of, just invite me to be part of it. So that's where I ran into Joe Swan, and I was, I was showing off identifying wines. And he said, "Hey, can you teach me how to do that?" And I said, "Yeah, I can teach you how to do that. Give me about 5 years." Wow. And he said, Yeah, said, I got 5 years, I got a room. By the way, I'm building a winery. You have any building skills? And I said, yeah, I actually have some building skills. So what do you, you know, what do you think? You know, what do you need? He said, what kind of building? And so we talked about that for a while. Ultimately, you know, I ended up rooming with Joe Swan on the weekends and on my vacations and helping him build his steel building, you know, which became his winery. And but he was planting a vineyard, and it was like, you know, making old vine Zinfandel, and he was making great wines and really interesting wines. And
well, it's funny that because you do attribute some of your knowledge and education to him, but yet he was asking you to help him learn to discern wine.
Well, I had a skill that he. I mean, he was a good wine taster, but you know, there's a method really, you know, that you kind of way of cataloging wines and flavors in your head when you're like doing this kind of blind identification. That's what he was interested in, but I think he just appreciated the scope of my knowledge, and he was a guy who was really interested in a lot of diversity in wines. And you know, like, so for instance, he loved, you know, Saint-Nicolas and Bourguil and Saint-Joseph, and like, so
that was prior to 76, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. No, I got involved with Joe Swan in 1972, so I saw the kind of the lot one, lot two, 72 wines, one made before the rains, one made after the rains. Yeah, I was fortunate enough to taste like his 68, which was quite remarkable. It was one of those sort of accidental wines that is like magic. And then so I went through the 73, 74, 75 harvest with him. And in 1976, he was kind enough to allow me to use some of his space to make my first vintage. So I did my first crush in 76 at Joe's Winery. And using pretty much the Swan methods, although I was Joe inoculated his wines because his consultant was Andrei Chelyshev, and Chelyshev was like, you know, he was pretty adamant about that. But I, you know, like I was convinced based on my experience in Europe that, you know, you could get spontaneous fermentations that were good and interesting. I went with spontaneous fermentation, whether I was just, you know, kind of stealing the atmospheric yeast from Joe or whether it was actually coming in the grapes, you know, remains to be, yeah. We'll never know, but, you know, but it could have been either way, but.
It's just in the air, isn't it?
It's in the air when it floats around. So, yeah, I've done a fair amount of study on this. So it appears that every vineyard has its own microbiome. Every vineyard has its own fingerprint. Some of those fingerprints are more likely to ferment than others. But, you know, I've rarely had a problem with wild yeast fermentation.
What an opportunity to work with Andre. Jealous, Jeff.
Yeah. I didn't really work with Andre so much as I was a bystander, you know, in the best of ways, you know. So, you know, Andre and Joe were actually quite good friends and had been friends for a very long time. So I got to sit at the dinner table and listen to Andre carry on as he was wont to do.
And smell his cigarette smoke, no doubt.
Yeah, well, he used to keep, you know, at Swan's, he'd keep three cigarettes burning at the same time. It was unbelievable. He'd have one in his hand, one in his mouth, and one in the ashtray. I mean, just like, oh, my God. I said, Andre, how do you taste wine?
Right.
He said, you know, I tried to stop smoking. He said, I was reasonably successful. He said, but it destroyed my palate. He says, I've been smoking since I was 10 years old. Everything I've ever tasted has been mask and cigarette smoke. He said, I don't recognize the flavors when they're not in consort with the cigarette smoke. So it was like, it was very funny. Yeah.
So when you made your first crush in 76, is that when you decided to put the stamp on it, Ravenswood?
Actually, it was later that Ravenswood came into being, but that was when I had the experience that gave me the Ravens image. My first harvest was done, you know, at the very kind of last minute, just as the rains were beginning to come in, and I was supposed to have the grapes picked, put in 50-pound lug boxes, and put on a truck, and I was just supposed to come up and pick up the truck and drive it away. Well, I got up to the vineyard and the grapes were picked, but they were spread over 4 acres of vineyard and it was beginning to rain. And I thought, oh my God, this is my first and only chance to make wine. What am I going to do? Well, I'm going to pick up all those grapes myself, or at least as many as I can get off the ground. And so, remember the days before cell phones when you couldn't call for help? Out in the middle of the vineyard. So I began loading these grapes, and these two huge birds, you know, these two big ravens floated into the vineyard and began kind of like doing this kind of interesting throat roll that ravens sometimes do. And it rained around me, and there were rainbows in the sky, and like it was the sun went down, and it was very, you know, sort of like bright kind of sunset in like this sort of stormy scene. And I thought, this is really strange. And it rained around me. It never rained on me. I got the truck loaded. The ravens hung out for the entire time I was loading that truck, which was about 4 hours. And I got it, drove it down to Joe's Winery, which is where I crushed the grapes that year. And the sky is like stayed, you know, full of water without dumping it on me. And we got to the winery, and Joe helped me offload the grapes late that night. And after we were finished crushing the grapes, the skies just opened up and poured. And I thought, wow, PFM, this is kind of quite remarkable.
Yeah, what a magical experience.
Yeah, so, you know, and I had gone to school in the Northwest, and I had remembered that ravens had been the trickster god of the Inuit Indians. And at the time, I was living in Berkeley and doing lots of Berkeley kinds of things and reading things like Carlos Castaneda's, you know, The Yaqui Way. And, you know, that's about peyote and, you know, and witch doctors and things like that. So finding your spirit, finding your totem was all part of that. And so Raven became my totem. But
interesting.
But it wasn't until 1978 when I had really come to the point of failure, because I'd run out of money, and I'd made a couple of vintages of wine, didn't have enough money to bottle the wine I'd made, and you know, so it was looking pretty grim. And a friend of mine said, "Oh," he says, "you like opera?" He said, "I know you can't afford to go to one, but maybe I'll take you to an opera." And I said, "Oh, great! What's playing?" He said, "Lucia de Lammermoor." I said, "Well, that'll cheer me up. And, like, everybody dies." And he said, "Yeah." He said, "You see how bad it can really be." And so we went to see Lucia, and of course, Lucia's, you know, like Romeo and Juliet gone worse. Everybody dies, and it's quite bloody, and you know, there's a lot of angst. And the erstwhile hero of this particular opera is called Edgardo Ravenswood. And while he falls on his sword in the opera, finally, to be with Lucia in heaven, in the book that's based on, which is a novel by Scott, you know, same guy who wrote Ivanhoe, his fate has been preordained by a soothsayer, and he will, you know, ride into the swamp and drown in the quicksand or the moor. So I'm thinking, wow, drowning in the quicksand, small wineries. There's a lot in common there, you know. So I got the angst, and I like the name. So Ravenswood became the name. And shortly after that, I found people who were willing to invest in a, you know, a winery with no possibilities.
Wow, weren't you a little nervous choosing the name of a person who had a preordained death?
It felt like me at the time. I could relate.
Well, that's a great story about how you came up with the name. Yeah. A couple of different ways of doing it with the ravens.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting Native American teachings from Don Juan.
Yeah, well, exactly, all that. And, you know, and of course, the raven stories are replete. I mean, you know, how about raven found man on a pod in the beach, and according to one story, and basically found these creatures and, you know, for his own amusement, kept them alive and, you know, stole the sun and the moon and the stars from other gods and did some, you know, pretty amazing stuff to sort of, like, keep his creatures alive, but always had this kind of, you know, sort of underworld connection, if you will. Yeah, so very mystical. And, you know, but the raven is a survivor. One of the really interesting things, it's probably like being pregnant, you know, when you're pregnant, everybody's pregnant. You know, you just look around and you say, oh, there's a pregnant one, and like, you know, and most of the time you don't even notice. Right. Yeah, well, you know, when you get yourself attached to ravens, it's like suddenly, you know, you see ravens everywhere, you know. So I went on a hike in Yosemite when I was doing the Vintner's Holiday in Yosemite, and I started up Bridal Veil Falls. And this raven, you know, checks in with me. And then, you know, a mile up the trail, checks in with me again. You know, get to the top. He's there waiting for me. You know, I have lunch, and this raven is sort of sitting up in the tree with me and follows me all the way down. So I had those kinds of experiences.
Were you on peyote, though?
Nope. I was totally straight.
Because Don Juan might have a few things to say about that, you know, whether the raven was really there or not. You know?
Yeah, well, there is that, you know. I'll leave that to Don Juan, because I'm enough of a skeptic of my own reality to recognize that that's a possibility.
Joel Peterson, I'm glad I had the chance to read Carlos Castaneda about his experiences with the Yaqui shaman Don Juan Matus. It's fascinating reading about the Native Americans' belief in spiritualism and being aware of what's around you, whether it's known or unknown. It's interesting reading, especially in your 20s. On the Wine Road continues with Joel Peterson next. We're back on the Wine Road. Today's guest is the winemaker and founder of Ravenswood Winery, Joel Peterson. He's a fascinating guy to spend time with, and I thoroughly enjoyed sitting and talking with him without time being a concern. At this point in our conversation, I referenced his good fortune.
I've been very fortunate. I've been incredibly lucky. I seem to be in the right place at the right time and didn't do anything too terribly foolish, although at the time sometimes they seemed a little extreme. But, you know, I really caught the wine business at a time when it was growing and at a time when...
You're riding the wave, the first big wave.
Really, definitely riding the first big wave. You know, like I caught this little tiny, ripple and it turned into Mavericks. I mean, it was like, you know, it was quite remarkable. But you could do a winery like this with, you know, you could start up something with almost no money, and if you could, you know, somehow capture people's imagination, you could grow it and you could turn it into something that was viable. And, you know, we did a lot of stuff along the way that was just kind of fun. I mean, our goal was not so much to be serious about wine per se, like my parents had been serious about wine. It was more to like enjoy, you know, the process. That probably came out of my my Don Juan hippie years, and it's like, you know, sort of the follow your bliss idea. Yeah, you know, that was Joseph Campbell.
When did you come up with the slogan "No Wimpy Wines"?
That was in the early '80s, and that was in part because of my partner. In the early 80s, you may recall, we started Vintner's Blend, which was really became known as Chateau Cashflow around the winery, because it was, you know, when you're growing winery, you desperately need a way to, you know, to move cash around, because, you know, think about it, if I'm making my single vineyard wines, they're really in the barrel for almost 2 years and they don't get into the market for like 2+ years, and then it takes you another year and a half to sell them. So this is cash flow that sucks. I mean, this is not good. So you need something you can get out of the winery in 10 months and you can, you know, you could sell in a shorter period of time.
Well, nowadays it's rosé.
Yeah,
and back then, did you do any white Zinfandel at all?
Well, that was exactly what, you know, my partners were requesting, was that I would make white Zinfandel. It was one of the options. And I said, I'm sorry, I don't do pink, I don't do sweet, I don't do wimpy. And we weren't. And in truth, we weren't really equipped to be able to do it. I wouldn't have done a very good job on it. We didn't have any stainless steel tanks. We were making everything in redwood. Yeah, you know, so it was not, you know, we didn't have any refrigeration. I mean, just like, you know, so it was not a viable option at the end of the day. But so I told him I wouldn't do wimpy wines, and kind of slightly tongue in cheek, I think, you know. And which is, you know, ultimately why I did Vintner's Blend, because it was a, you know, real wine. It was a red and it fit into the wheelhouse of what we were doing. But in those days, we sold every case of wine ourselves. So I'd call in accounts, and Reed would call in accounts. And Reed was a real estate guy by training.
He was your partner.
He was the other general partner in the Ravenswood Limited Partnership. And so he went into Greg O'Flynn's establishment, the California Wine and Merchant down on Chestnut Street. And Greg said, "Well, when are you going to make White Zinfandel? White Zinfandel's hot. I'd buy White Zinfandel from you." Reed just shakes his head and said, "I don't think that's going to happen." Joel's adamantly opposed to it. In fact, he says, he has a sign over the fermenters that says, "No wimpy wines allowed." Well, of course, there was no sign, and he just made it up. But Greg called sometime later and said, "By the way, I'm coming to Sonoma. I like your wines. Love to taste what you got in barrel. And by the way, I want to see the sign." I said, "The sign? What sign's that, Greg?" He says, "You know, the one over the fermenters that says, 'No wimpy wines allowed.'" And I'm going, okay. I knew it had to be Reed, so I called him up and said, "What's this about a sign?" And he said, "Oh, yeah, I did say that." I said, "Yeah, well, he's coming up. He wants to see the sign. You better have one made so you don't look, you know, bad." So we still have a sign in the taste room, actually.
The exact same sign from that.
Exact same sign from that time. So, nice. Yeah. So he had his son made a sign for us, and so it it was there when, you know, when Greg arrived. But that became sort of the root, because it described what we did, you know, pretty well. It wasn't about making wines that were like, you know, giant Harley Davidson wines or like, you know, these things that were massive. It was about making wines that were authentically what they were supposed to be, as opposed to sort of ersatz wine, which is what I consider to be white Zinfandel. I mean, yes, it's, you know, it's certainly a style of wine, but in terms of sacrilege to a great grape, it was. I mean, so you think about, you know, the whole notion of wimpy. People usually think about massive, but, you know, you look at somebody like Baryshnikov, you know, he was a ballet dancer. I mean, like, but that was not a wimpy ballet dancer, I can tell you. Oh, yeah. You know, think about, you know, somebody like Einstein, you know. Yeah, he was a scientist. Like, he spent a lot of time doing, you know, like mental calculations, but no wimp, I can tell you. He did, you know, some of the most amazing, you know, things. But so really, that's what the kind of no wimpy thing was about. But it became, you know, became one of those things that people caught on to. When we had, before it was done, we had bumper stickers in multiple languages and bouncy balls and, you know, all sorts of, you know.
Now you have cycling shirts.
Cycling shirts and, you know, hats. And I mean, the guy was like, you know, and that combined with the logo that David Goins had done, you know, when I had done him in Berkeley, with the three ravens, you know, holding arms, really put us kind of in a, you know, marketing. But I talk about luck. I mean, we didn't do those things because we were in intelligent marketers. We just did them because we liked them and they were interesting. So that logo is probably the most tattooed wine logo in the wine business.
I remember hearing that once before. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I've seen over 100, and, you know, so when you walk in, when I walk into a restaurant and somebody says, "Oh, I've got something I want to show you," that's code for, "I'm taking my clothes off now to show you my tattoo." So I've seen some pretty interesting tattoos and pretty interesting spots.
Right. Yeah. So what was it about Zinfandel that captured your creative imagination?
Zinfandel was an amazing grape, actually. So I had grown up drinking, you know, Bordeaux a lot, and Burgundy and things like that. And so when I kind of initially began to get my feet wet in the wine business, I thought really maybe I wanted to do a Bordeaux blend, you know, what we call a Meritage these days. Mm-hmm. But in 1976, yeah, there was Cabernet planted, and there may have been a splattering of Cabernet Franc someplace. But, yeah, my goal was to have all these grapes planted in exactly the same place. So Cabernet Franc, you know, Merlot, Petit Verdot, Malbec, and Cabernet Sauvignon. So I could do a Bordeaux blend that was sort of, you know, a reprise, if you will, of Bordeaux. Those grapes didn't exist. And I had obviously spent time with Joe Swan, and what I learned was that Zinfandel could make great wine. It happened by accident at least twice. So Joe Swan, who wanted to make Pinot Noir, needed to practice before his Pinot Noir came into existence. There really wasn't much Pinot Noir planted back then either, surprisingly. So he made Zinfandel. He had his old patch of Zinfandel in 1968 in Forestville, and he made it like he was going to make his Pinot Noir. Well, up until that point, you know, even though pre-Prohibition there had been great wines made from Zinfandel, they were being made in big concrete fermenters and jug wine, so nobody was paying any attention to them. So Joe Swan did them in small open-top fermenters, and he put them in French oak, and he left them in the barrel for a while, and it turned out to be a magical phenomenon. And Ridge did the same thing. Dave Banyan, you know, was waiting for his Cabernet to come in. Had to practice making Cabernet, so instead of making it like Pinot Noir, he made it like Cabernet. And lo and behold, you know, Ridge is as well known for Zinfandel now as they are for Montebello. But they were interesting, really good wines, and really unique to California. You know, at the time, we didn't know Zinfandel was grown anyplace else, and it's really not grown anyplace else. You know. This is a much better growing place for it than almost any place in the world. You know, even Croatia, you go to Croatia and, you know, the growing conditions are not good for Zinfandel, which is why they grow almost no Zinfandel anymore, and why they have something called Plavac Mali, which is the son of Zinfandel, which has been crossed with a grape to make it thicker skinned and looser clustered and, you know, more resistant to mildew and all the rest of the things that go on, you know, with Zin. Plus they got these cold winds and they have these hot winds, and it's like, you know, just, it's a crazy place. So
even most of the United States doesn't drink Zinfandel. You know, it's kind of limited to the West Coast?
Yeah, well, I don't know. You know, you can get people who drink it in New York, and there are lots of people who drink it in Florida.
People who found it and learned
people,
to love it.
Yeah. And people who drink it in Texas, and they get it, upper Midwest, there's a fair amount of drinking of Zinfandel, particularly during the winter. And Canada, they pound Zinfandel in Canada, so it's fantastic. Yeah.
You know that because you sell to them, right?
That's exactly right. I go to Canada a fair amount, and I have a very enthusiastic wine-consuming group in Canada that loves Zinfandel.
So Ravenswood gets to be quite popular, and it's spread across the U.S., and you at some point just decided to step away a little bit.
Well, not for a while. Yeah, you know, I mean, I was full-time up until... I guess last year, and I'm still effectively two-thirds time, and still doing, which means I'm working full-time instead of time and a half.
Right.
But I'm 70, and so I decided that it was time to kind of retool, if you will. You know, I've got about probably, if I'm lucky, 10 more good constructive working years in my life, and what I really wanted was a small winery, and... And for lots of reasons, that wasn't to be. And so I've gone back and started a new winery, if you will, really making wine the way Joe Swan and I made wine, small open-top redwood fermenters. In fact, some of the same redwood fermenters that I was using at Ravenswood up until 2001. Using very select vineyards and only making as much wine as I can make myself with a small amount of help. It's been great fun. I'm going back and having the winery I wanted to have instead of the winery I ended up with.
So that's the once in future you're talking about?
That's once in future. So once I had a little winery, in the future I'll have a little winery. You know, once I made wine all in redwood fermenters, small. And once in the future I'll do the same. I'm quite happy with it. And, I've got the good fortune, once again, good luck, to have a son who went into the wine business, and he does a winery called Bedrock Wine Company, and he's been quite successful. So I'm able to use his space. He was, I think he was a little chagrined when I showed up with the redwood fermenters on the back of my truck. I show up, and he comes out, and he looks at me, and he looks at the fermenters, and he looks at the fermenters, and he looks at me, and he says, "Yeah, I see you got the band back together." So I put my fermenters in among his process.
He's had some international acclaim, hasn't he?
Oh yeah, he's done very, very well. He's a very he's very smart. He's very collegial. He's talented.
And no surprise that he's your son, the way you describe him. So, and knowing that you're well-read, I was wondering if maybe you got the Once in Future from the Once in Future King book.
Well, I read that book, and in fact, my wife actually is the one who brought it up. She said this is a really good name for your second project because it really sort of like gives you the kind of the reincarnation kind of concept. So that was in mind. It wasn't that I was trying to be King Arthur, trying to be the once and future king, but...
I thought it was your subtle way of trying to steal that King of Zinfandel title from Ken Rosenblum.
Ken Rosenblum, yeah. Now, I got dubbed the godfather of Zinfandel a long time ago, so I'm quite happy with that title.
Yeah,
I don't need to be king. It may be good to be king, but it's better to be the godfather.
Yeah. Well, James Brown was the godfather of soul, and that worked well with him.
Worked well for him, exactly. Yeah.
If his new project and the many organizations he belongs to isn't enough, Joel is also hooked up with his son Morgan, winemaker Tegan Passalacqua of Turley Wine Cellars, even British wine writer and critic Jancis Robinson, as well as others, as members of the Historic Vineyard Society, a nonprofit organization to compile a comprehensive, consistent directory of California's heritage vineyards.
Yes, and the idea was that there are lots of these really amazing signature vineyards, really, in California that have been around for a long time, and many of them are at risk, partly because they didn't have really good winemakers making wine for them, but partly because they're like Oakley, where they're sitting out there in a newly developing space, and they're going to be torn up. So the question is, how do you get these grapes enough recognition to keep them in the ground? And how do you have, you know, credible winemakers making wine from them so that they have a reputation, which helps keep them in the ground? So the whole idea was to sort of, you know, keep these old vineyards vital, because they really are part of California's heritage. There are lots of grapes grown in the world in various places, but there's virtually no place else in the world that has grapevines as old as we have them. And Zinfandel is unique in this respect, because it will live for a long time. Cabernet doesn't do so well because it's susceptible to Utaipa. But we have some, you know, 50-plus-year-old vineyards in California that are Chardonnay as well. So there's some really interesting vineyards out there.
It's wonderful to see them with such appreciation of history and doing something about it.
Yes, indeed. And they do have an appreciation of history. I mean, if you look at people like Mike Officer and Morgan, and, you know, they can walk through a vineyard and they can, one, tell you, like, sort of what the historical references are for this vineyard. But they can also walk through and they can identify every obscure grape variety you can imagine in it, just by looking at the leaves and the vine and, you know, and sometimes the fruit. Yeah, so, you know, this is their project. I'm tagging on, and, you know, I give them as much support as I can possibly do, but they're doing a great job, and I encourage them all I can.
Well, you're 70, so that means you have, what, another 20 years of winemaking ahead of you?
Well, I hope so. You know, one can only hope when you get to be 70. You know, I used to work in hospitals a lot, so I know that 70 comes in lots of forms, and the world can change very quickly. But if I'm really lucky, I'll get to, you know, play Andrei Chelyachev and hang out until I'm in my mid-90s and do what I do. But for now, I'm just taking it a day at a time, you know, back to the Berkeley days. Go with the flow, you know, and just enjoy every day as much as you can.
Hey, it's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
It's been a real pleasure to share the casual conversation I had with Joel Peterson with you today. One thing I didn't get a chance to bring up during our time together was the fact that he never stopped working in the science field. After moving up to Napa to work with Joseph Swan, Joel continued to work nights in the lab at Sonoma Valley Hospital, and did so until 1992, when the winery's popularity took off. It was a respectable effort to make sure his family was financially secure. Joel has now joined Andrei Chelyachev as a member of the Vintners Hall of Fame, voted in by his peers. What an engaging, talented, and self-proclaimed lucky man. Thanks for joining me on the Wine Road. I'm Jeff Davis.